sharing a laugh with God. She even names her son Isaac. He laughs, not only in honor of the joy God has brought to her life, a joy so great it bubbles over into endless laughter, all the laughter she missed all those long years, but also in memory of her own faithless laughter, her moment of doubt. From now on, every time she calls her son's name, she will remember, "Once I laughed at God, but now God laughs with me. Now he shares my joy." Sarah wrestled with and fell prey to many, if not all, of the temptations you and I face during our waiting seasons. She fell and fell hard. She wept and wept hard. But that was not the end of her story. Her faith survived. Her marriage survived. Her laughter survived. I don't know how your waiting story ends. How long will you wait, and will God say yes? But this I know. You may be sad and struggling now, but God can restore laughter in the end. He can bring back joy after months, years, even decades of waiting. He can bring back joy after you have doubted and questioned. He can bring back joy after you have made mistakes. Yes, even the kind with lasting consequences. He can use your wait to shape you, make you stronger and more Christ-like. Waiting is a journey of testing, fraught with spiritual danger, but rife with opportunity. Like Sarah, like us, each of our Bible heroes had to decide how to think and who to be during their in-between times. They didn't get everything they wanted, but many of them became the people God wanted them to be. God used their waiting times to shape them into instruments he could use for powerful purposes. If you have already given in to some of waiting's pitfalls, if you are struggling even now as you read, hear this, know this. Your story isn't over. You can stumble and fall. You can question and doubt, and God can help you set it right. You can get the last laugh. Best of all, you can laugh with God. Waiting Room Reading. For further study. For Sarah's full life story, read Genesis chapter 11, verse 27 through chapter 23, verse 20. Journal prompt. Take some time to identify which specific pitfalls are most threatening to you. What scriptures can help you battle those temptations? Here are a few that have helped me. Bitterness, James chapter 5, verses 7 through 11. Doubt. Psalm 37, verses 25 and 26, and James chapter 5, verses 16 through 18. Manipulation. Psalm 33, verses 11 through 22, and 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. Cynicism. Psalm 40, verses 1 through 3. I love the Message version of this one. Envy. Psalm 73 and James chapter 3, verses 13 through 18. Prayer prompt. I remain confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. Psalm 27, verses 13 and 14.
Chapter 3. Survival Skills for Spiritual Waiting. Hannah's Story. Year After Year. Based on 1 Samuel, Chapter 1. Trip to Shiloh, Year 1. Hannah snuggles in bed with Elkanah after the sacrifice, their noses almost touching. "What did you pray for at the temple today?" she asks, tracing his stubbled jawline with one finger, still learning its shape. "For you." He brushes a soft kiss against her forehead. "For our life to come, for strong sons with big appetites, sweet daughters with their mother's eyes. He teases, pressing a warm palm against her flat stomach. She giggles, a series of images dancing across her imagination. A dark-eyed girl with dimples and braids. A fat baby boy, his legs a series of chubby rolls. Isaac, she says. We'll name the first boy Isaac, because he will make us laugh. But for now, I'm happy just to be here with you. Trip to Shiloh, Year 4. Elkanah wraps a strong arm around Hannah. She curves her back into his chest, hoping he doesn't realize she is using the position to hide tears. What did you pray for at the temple today? She forces her voice steady. For us, he says, his breath warm against her ear. It will happen soon. I believe that. His strong voice radiates confidence. Confidence she wishes she could feel. She tries to borrow it, but the harder she chases, the faster it flees. He squeezes her tight. Next year, you'll bring a baby here with you. She nods, not trusting her voice, hoping he accepts the nod, doesn't ask questions, make her speak, find out how much she has begun to doubt. Trip to Shiloh, Year 9. Hannah curls alone in bed, feeling the cold from Elkanah's empty spot seep over to her side. She presses fingertips against her eyelids, so hard they set bursts of starlight swirling. How she wishes bright spots could erase today's images. Peninnah, Elkanah's other wife, the center of every conversation around the well, all the women passing six-month-old Jacob around, marveling that Peninnah is already expecting again, her fourth child in as many years. God has smiled upon you, Peninnah. Elkanah can't get enough of you, can he? Every time he looks at you, you get pregnant. Hannah fights to unremember their sideways glances, the accusations hurled without words. What sin did Hannah commit that she can't get pregnant, while Peninnah can't stop? It is midnight before Elkanah creeps in, his every movement an apology. Sorry, he whispers. Peninnah needed me. She's sick again, and the baby won't sleep. I don't want to know, Hannah snaps. If she needs you so much, why don't you stay with her tonight? Elkanah's silence cuts worse than anger. Regret spears her. I'm sorry. She reaches a hand out blind, wanting to take back the words, draw him in close. I'm glad you came to me. She can't find his hand in the dark. Trip to Shiloh, Year 12. Hannah sits beside Elkanah at the feast, embarrassed by the double portion of meat on her plate, pushing it around, choking down small bites for Elkanah's sake. Peninnah's resentful gaze scalds her, even across the long table. Elkanah leans in close, whispering, "You're all I want, all I need. Aren't I worth more than 10 sons? The tears surprise her. After so many years, you should be beyond sorrow. She blinks hard. Halfway through the meal, Peninnah's 2-year-old, Joshua, toddles over and tugs on Hannah's skirts. Hannah can't help but adore him. She cared for him herself all those long months when Peninnah huddled in bed, listless and crying. Sometimes he still gets confused, calls both women Mama. Joshua raises his arms with an impish smile, purple leaves clutched in one pudgy fist. For half a breath, she can't help the fantasy. What if he were mine? She draws him into her lap, squeezing the squishy skin at his waist. He squirms sideways, squealing, and pushes the flowers into her chest. She plucks the crumpled offering from his fingers. For me? He nods proudly, and she nestles her chin into his soft, dark hair. From you? Giggling, he shakes his head no. From Mama. Real Mama. Hannah's stomach coils into a fist, and she looks more closely at the blooms. Mandrakes, the flower of fertility, or so all the old women said. Eat their fruit, inhale their heady scent, hang them over your bed, and you will be pregnant in no time. If she had a coin for every time she had heard that, tried that. Humiliation sets fire to her cheeks. Joshua slips from her lap, toddles back to his mother. Real mama. Across the table, Peninnah picks him up, flashing a grin at Hannah, her smile a sword. For you, she mouths, for tonight. Around the table, other women are watching, weighing, whispering. Hannah staggers to her feet. She feels Elkanah's fingers brush against her wrist. Stay. But she is already gone. Tear-blind, she stumbles outside, gasping, hearing Elkanah's voice calling, so small, so far. He has never been so far away. She lifts her skirts and breaks into a sprint, not knowing where she is headed, just running, somewhere, anywhere, away. She doesn't remember getting there, doesn't remember heaving open the heavy door, but she is in the temple, violent sobs ripping her apart, shredding her heart, turning her insides out. Eyes squeezed shut, tears raining down, fists clenched tight, nails drawing blood, gasping with grief, clawing at prayer. She can't make a sound, can hardly draw breath. For a moment, she wishes the sorrow would do it. Kill her. End this. How can a heart so long dead keep on beating? Somehow her mind forms words. Remember me, Lord. Remember me. Give me a son, and I will give him back to you. A raspy voice breaks in. Enough. Enough of your wine. For shame coming drunk to God's temple. Horrified, Hannah's eyes fly open. She swipes at her swollen eyes and finds the priest, Eli, glaring at her from his chair by the temple door. His eyes deliver the wrath of God. She chokes out words, her chest hitching with sobs. Not so, my Lord. I pour out my soul to the Lord from grief. Eli strokes his long beard, studying her. He gives a tiny nod, waves her forward. He takes her trembling hands in his, turns over the palms, brushes calloused thumbs over the crescent-shaped wounds in her palms. His eyes soften, crinkle up at her. Go in peace, daughter. May God grant what you have asked. He closes his eyes and mouths a prayer of his own. Hannah's breath stops. Hope, long banished, sprouts wings in her chest. Shy, cautious, the tiniest of flutterings. Thank you, my Lord, she breathes. That night she reaches for Elkanah, kissing words into his shoulder. I prayed in the temple today. He wakes, she smiles, hope flies in the dark.
This went on year after year. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 7. Not day after day, week after week, or even month after month, but year after year. Some of us can barely wait for our coffee to brew in the morning without a nervous breakdown. Don't judge me. How in the name of all that is good and holy are we supposed to survive weeks, months, or years of delay for the real blessings? When first we begin to wait, we may be okay for a while. We drift along, treading water, sure our circumstances will change any day now. Any day now. But when things don't change and the wait stretches longer than we were prepared for, and let's be honest, any delay is longer than we were prepared for, we may begin to flounder spiritually. The spiritual habits we have had, the prayer life we have led, the simple, unexamined faith we have relied on, they aren't enough anymore. If we don't seriously up our efforts at survival, we start to tire, to struggle, to drown. Is that where you are now? Legs cramping, lungs protesting, arms aching, struggling to keep your head above water, choking on mouthfuls of salt water? During seasons of waiting, we have to develop a new set of spiritual survival skills. We have to build new muscles, try different strategies, expand our approach. We might have to find a life preserver to help us stay afloat or climb up onto a life raft. What are these survival skills for spiritual waiting, and how do we develop them? Survival skill number one, show up to prayer. Hannah was a woman of prayer. When first we meet her in 1 Samuel chapter 1, we find her trying to eat at the house of the Lord. But her bitter rival wife has provoked her, dug a knife into the painful wound, and twisted to the point of despair. Hannah can't eat, can't even stay in the same room. How tempting it must have been to respond in an unrighteous way. Maybe Hannah was a fighter and she was tempted to stand there and throw down with Peninnah. Duke it out once and for all. Horrible confession that reveals how un-Jesus-like I can be. I kind of wish the Bible gave us a scene where Hannah goes Jackie Chan on Peninnah. Or maybe Hannah was a runner, tempted to go hide and throw herself an epic pity party. Totally what I would have done. But Hannah decided to be a prayer. Once while they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, and 12 through 17. Even after so many years of begging for the same thing, so many years with arms still empty, Hannah kept praying. And hers were no wooden, distant, "Why do I waste my time?" prayers. No, she humbly poured out her soul to God, even after all those years, year after year. Think about it. Prayer is what caught Eli's attention. Prayer secured the promise Hannah needed. Prayer paved the way for her to have a son, her miracle baby, Samuel. When you have been waiting forever, you will be tempted to stop praying. Pray anyway. You might think, "I've already asked God for this 5 gazillion times. He must be sick of hearing from me." Pray anyway. You might think, "I have nothing new to say." Pray anyway. You might have to get creative to feel connected. Take prayer walks, sit outside, find a prayer partner, write down your prayers. But don't give up on prayer during this time. You need it now more than ever. Survival skill number two, show up to worship. I wonder if Hannah gradually came to dread the family's annual trek to Shiloh to worship. As with all family traditions, this one probably came to serve as a marker for the progress of their family life. Remember the year Peninnah was pregnant again, and the caravan had to stop every 5 minutes so she could throw up? Remember the year Hannah had a miscarriage on the way? Remember the year all Peninnah's kids got a stomach bug on the last night? As years passed, the experience must have darkened. With competition intensifying between wives, Elkanah fought harder to make Hannah feel special, but his kindness only fueled the feud. How Hannah's memories must have been colored with loss, shot through with grief, warped by unkindness. Happy memories for others, all pain for Hannah, year after year. I wonder if Hannah ever thought about skipping worship altogether, staying home alone with her grief. In year two of my struggle to get pregnant, six women in our small congregation got pregnant, all due within 3 weeks of each other. Six women, 3 weeks, one church. I know, it's ridiculous. Please take a moment to feel very, very sorry for me. How excited the whole church was, especially when they announced that all six babies would be boys. I could hardly walk through the fellowship without brushing up against someone's burgeoning belly. Or worse, a whole group of bellies circled together as the mom-to-be club rubbed tummies, felt babies kick, compared notes on birth plans and breastfeeding, giggling and glowing and just looking so doggone happy. To their credit, they weren't being insensitive or unkind or trying to leave me out. It was just one of those things. They couldn't help being pregnant altogether, and I couldn't help being infertile all alone. It was all I could do not to gnash my teeth and wail through every church service. But you know what? I kept showing up to church. I hid in the bathroom and cried sometimes, and I made a lot of emergency Starbucks mocha consolation runs on the way home. But I kept showing up. Why? Because my husband was the campus minister and I didn't want him to get fired. No, that's not really why. Okay, maybe sometimes it was a little bit why. But really, during that desert period, I needed worship more than ever. I needed time with God's people, even the pregnant ones, to restore my faith and rekindle my connection with the Lord. I needed to pray, to sing, to hear the spoken word, to be around people who could lift my faith when it flagged. I needed to serve in the church, to get my eyes off my own sadness. It was worship that brought Hannah the blessing she sought. When you are waiting, you will have despairing days, days when you want to hole up in your room and huddle in the dark with sad thoughts. Worshiping God, especially in a congregational setting, will feel like the worst idea in the world. How can joyful songs come from a heart riddled with loss? Don't give in. Worship will minister to you in ways you don't even know you need. It will fill holes in your soul you don't realize you have, gaps you can't fill yourself. Worship might make you feel vulnerable and exposed. It might tug on emotional cords you would rather keep hidden, protected and private. It might make you go there when you would really rather not. It might make you cry at church, maybe even ugly cry like Hannah. But you know what? That's not a bad thing. God wants to meet us on an emotional level, and worship is one of the ways he draws us out and connects with us. Worship proves especially powerful in times when God feels distant and our prayer life feels blocked. Sometimes worship corrects our thinking. There's something about singing, not just singing along in a car, but standing beside other Christians singing to live music, that wakes something inside and even helps us make sense of biblical truths. I love the psalmist's confession in Psalm 73. He's been looking around, envying godless people because their lives seem so carefree, so easy. He's caught in a spiral of bitter, godless, envious thoughts until he steps into the house of God to worship. But as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I had nearly lost my foothold, for I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. When I tried to understand all this, it troubled me deeply, till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Psalm 73, verses 2 and 3, and 16 and 17. Worship gives us perspective, reminding us that as big as our problems feel, as much as we hurt, there's a whole world out there in need of God, in need of our faith to make a difference. Worship reminds us of the power of God, the power He can exercise on our behalf. Worship reminds us that God is God, and we are not. Worship helps us understand and accept God's love. Worship helps us appeal to God even when we don't know how to pray. Worship helps us heal. Worship helps us wait. Survival skill number 3, show up for time in God's word. Waiting can bleed us dry, drain our hope, our happiness, our heart. But God's word can fill us back up again. If waiting is a desert, then God's word is the oasis where we pause to refresh our water supply. When I'm waiting on God, prayer takes more energy and work than usual. But the Bible has been my saving grace. When God seems silent on the other end of my prayers, His word is the cord that keeps us connected and helps me find His voice. When my path weaves down into the darkness of the valley of the shadow of death, Psalm 23 verse 4, King James Version, the Bible is a lamp for my feet, a light on my path, Psalm 119 verse 105. During times of loneliness and financial strain, I have loved these words from God to Moses. I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out, and I am concerned about their suffering. Exodus chapter 3 verse 7. What does this scripture show us? I have seen. I have heard. I am concerned. God sees. God hears. God cares. Repeat that to yourself 1,000 times a day if need be. God sees. God hears. God cares. When I was waiting to find the guy, I took great comfort in passages where God declares His love for us. Since you are precious and honored in my sight, and because I love you, I will give people in exchange for you, nations in exchange for your life. Isaiah chapter 43 verse 4. Therefore, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. I will betroth you to me forever. Hosea chapter 2 verses 14, 16, and 19. As our baby waiting days stretched long, Satan kept whispering, God doesn't love you. He wants you to suffer. I began to question God's kindness, but then I found this. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for Him. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in Him, to the one who seeks Him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Though He brings grief, He will show compassion. So great is His unfailing love. For He does not willingly bring affliction or grief to anyone. Lamentations chapter 3, verses 21 through 26 and 32 through 33. What a comfort to realize that God doesn't want us to be miserable. When difficulty comes, He hurts with us. Just as a parent suffers when a child goes through a painful time of growth, so God suffers with us, His children. When we miscarried in the same week that we moved out of our dream home and moved 2 states away from family and friends, I thought I would wait forever for God to heal us and restore happiness. For months, I clung to Psalm 86. Bring joy to your servant, Lord, for I put my trust in you. Teach me your way, Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness. Give me an undivided heart, that I may fear your name. Give me a sign of your goodness, that my enemies may see it and be put to shame. For you, Lord, have helped me and comforted me. Verses 4, 11, and 17. Even now, I return to these passages whenever my faith grows weary, and their effect on me is almost instantaneous. By helping to lift my eyes off problems and up to heaven, they restore my faith, revive my hope, and remind me of God's love. I urge you to find scriptures like these, your scriptures, to plot your course through in-between times. Find the passages that fix you, that save you, while you wait. Let them serve as your roadmap through the lonely, unmarked waiting territory. Carry them with you. Write them on your fridge, your mirror, your hand, your heart. Read them over and over until you believe them, and their message sinks deep down into your soul and changes you, even heals you. When Amber broke up with the boy she had hoped to marry, she watched friend after friend fall in love, experience epic romance, get engaged, and married. As her friends drove around town listening to sappy love songs and picking out reception playlists, Amber drove alone, blasting "You Give Love a Bad Name" as loud as her ears could take it. The year after the breakup, the year she thought she would be planning her own wedding, she was a bridesmaid 3 times, and that was just the beginning. Amber survived by printing and laminating 3 scriptures about envy. She kept them in her wallet and read them anytime she was tempted with envy, which for a while there was every 7.3 minutes. That little laminated lifesaver salvaged her sanity and her relationships on more than one occasion, most notably this one. For the 20th time, Amber finds herself at a bridal shower for a younger friend, a friend she adores but is tempted to resent. "It's not fair, God. Why does she get to get married fresh out of college, and here I sit going on mercy dates with dorky guys?" When the friend opens the 3rd set of white dishes to a chorus of oohs and ahs, Amber can't fake smile anymore. She sneaks out and hides herself in the room with the coats and purses, sobbing on the floor. With shaking hands, she pulls out her laminated scriptures and reads them through tears, over and over and over. In the mysterious way of God, the scriptures go to work, reminding her of what's true. Amber's sobs fade. Her heart softens. She finds she can pray, can release her pain to God. She finds she doesn't hate her friend after all. She finds strength to dry her eyes, take a deep breath, and return to the shower. It feels like days, but it's only been 10 minutes. She finds she can clap, even throw in an ooh or ah of her own, and genuinely share in her friend's happiness. That's the power of the Word of God. Survival skill number 4. Show up for fun. Sometimes when we're waiting for the life we want, we forget to enjoy the life we already have. It may be incomplete and imperfect, and keep in mind, everyone's life is incomplete and imperfect, but it's still a life. Your life, God's gift to you. Even though Hannah might have been tempted to stay home from the trek to Shiloh every year, she probably needed the break from the mundane rhythm of daily life. Surely there were some joyous traditions she enjoyed along the way. Nights around campfires, singing and telling stories, sweet moments with Elkanah, the husband who loved her, empty arms, broken womb, damaged heart, and all. During one of my waiting seasons, I took up new hobbies to keep life interesting. I tried crocheting and knitting. More accurately, I failed crocheting and knitting. I got a dog, competed in triathlons, dabbled in gardening, wrote a novel, and rediscovered my love of writing. I bought, wait for it, an oboe. You should have witnessed the conversation when I told my husband, Kevin. Me, to Kevin, quietly, I want to get an oboe. Kevin, not looking up from his computer. Mm-hmm. Good. You should help a hobo. Me, louder. I said, I want to get an oboe. Kevin, snort laughing. A what? Oh, yeah, the weird instrument? The one you used to play in middle and high school that sounds like a dying duck? That would be hilarious. Good one. Me, awkward silence. Kevin, looking up and seeing hurt all over my face. Oh, you were serious? Me, yeah. Kevin sits there for 5 minutes trying to rearrange his face into a supportive expression. But 2 weeks later, I was the proud meaning kind of embarrassed, owner of a used oboe. I can only imagine the thoughts going through Kevin's beleaguered brain as he handed over the money, the words he had to fight not to say out loud. Hi, music store owner. This is keep my wife happy so she doesn't mope around the house money, and it's all yours. But you know what? I enjoyed picking up an old skill. I even performed a few times at church. It was good for me to find joy in a new, old skill, and to find fresh purpose for something I'd love to do in the past. Don't just sit around waiting for the life you want. Fill the days you have. Try new things. Take new risks. Remain social. Get out of the house. Keep your life fun and interesting. Survival skill number 5. Show up for self-reflection. Don't waste your suffering. I have heard this said by a number of godly women I respect, and what wisdom it is. Waiting is a form of suffering, and like it or not, it's an opportunity to grow, an opportunity we would not choose for ourselves, but an opportunity nonetheless. We all have watched waiting destroy people, steal dreams, harden hearts, strangle joy. It transforms their entire personalities, making them bitter, envious, and jaded. They start stiff-arming the people who love them, and before long, they are angry with God, alone in the crowd. They spend so much time asking why and why me and how long, all questions without answers that lead only to anger and frustration, that they forget about the real issues, the questions they can answer, the answers they can choose. How will I use this time, and who will I become while I wait? But we have seen other people grow, even flourish, through seasons of waiting. Maybe they didn't want to ride this particular roller coaster, but they are strapped in and the ride has started and they can't get off till it ends, so they find a way to enjoy it. They keep their eyes open, wave their hands around a bit, and get the full experience. They don't just survive the ride, they live it. Seasons of waiting are a great time to start journaling. I know, all the math and science-brained people just had a minor panic attack. Apologies. Journaling doesn't come naturally to everybody, but it's worth a try. I predict you will find it a source of relief, a place to vent, question, and process. At the end of every chapter, you will find journal prompts. If you aren't already doing so, try writing down your answers to the questions. The physical act of writing will help you to think on a deeper level and make connections you might not make just by sitting and pondering. Even if you don't usually love writing, I think you'll find that journaling ministers to you during waiting seasons, that it does something healing to your heart. For starters, try writing down answers to questions like these. What does the Bible teach me about God's character that is still true even while I'm waiting? How do I see God taking care of me while I'm waiting? If I could change one thing about how I'm handling this waiting season, what would it be? Survival skill number 6, show up to serve. We won't camp out on this point because we have a whole chapter devoted to finding purpose during in-between times, chapter 10, but serving can redeem your season of waiting. If you can find a place to give or a person who needs you, you won't get sucked into the trap of selfishness and self-pity that Satan has laid for you. Your days will have meaning. Your life will hold joy. Lose your life through service and sacrifice, and you might just find yourself along the way. Luke chapter 9, verse 24. Survival skill number 7. Don't show up to social media as often. Here's a transcript of a recent conversation between me and my sister, who is suffering through her own agonizing baby weight, complete with weekly humiliations in paper gowns. Alexandra, everyone I know is pregnant. Me, have you thought about editing your newsfeed and blocking pregnancy stories? Alexandra, 3 days later. I now have only 2 people left in my newsfeed, Uncle Dave and Dad's 70-year-old friend Jack. They go to the doctor almost as often as I do. Me, laughing, crying, laugh crying. Listen, friend, this is just practical advice one waiter to another. There is nothing wrong with social media, but when you're waiting, social media is probably not the best place to spend all your spare time. Not unless you have a spiritual superpower that makes you immune to envy. I'm not saying you need to add complete social media deprivation to your list of afflictions, but you may need to take some breaks for sanity's sake. Or at least take social media in smaller doses. The day you find out you didn't get into the college or grad school you wanted? Not the day to torment yourself with everyone else's "look at me wearing my school t-shirt" updates. The day the guy ignores you for the 800th day in a row? Not the day to go scroll through pictures of all your friends looking all cute and couple-y with their boyfriends. The day your adoption proceedings suffer another delay? Not the time to suffer through friends' Instagram pictures of their adorable children. During times like this, opt for face-to-face friendship instead of Facebook friendship. Seek the company of friends over the phone or in person instead of seeking comfort in social media connections. Just be smart. You know your own heart, your own struggles, and what you can handle without flushing your smartphone down the toilet. Your social life won't go down in flames if you take a few weeks off of social media, or even if you decide to sign off altogether for a season. Really, you will still have friends, you will still have fun, and you will still find ways to learn what's going on in the world. Survival skill number 8. Show up to laugh. Waiting stinks. Duh. We have established that. And you will have dark days. We have established that. But keep laughing. Let's revisit Amber's story, backing up to her pre-breakup days. Every moment with the boy feels like a perfect proposal opportunity. She keeps her nails perfect, hair curled, makeup fresh. Makes a secret Pinterest wedding board. They attend a mutual friend's wedding. Ooh, a proposal on the way home from a wedding would be super sweet. And this scene plays out. DJ, all right, all the single ladies to the dance floor for the bouquet toss. Laughing, Amber joins the jostling crowd of giggling girls. Flowers fly. Elbows fly. Amber flies. She lands triumphant, waving the bouquet and beaming. It's a sign from God. I really am about to get engaged. She turns to share a significant glance with her significant other and finds him frozen at the front of the crowd, staring at her with a look of abject horror on his face. Never in the history of commitment phobia has a man's expression so clearly screamed, terrified of marriage, not even remotely ready to propose. Confused and embarrassed, Amber creeps off the dance floor. You know what got her through that night? Picturing her friends' faces when she told the story. Sure enough, the next day they made all the appropriate faces and sympathy sounds, and somehow they laughed about it. It was just so awful, they had to laugh. Amber and Mr. Afraid of Marriage broke up a few weeks later. She is now happily married to a man who is not afraid of marriage, though she waited several years to find him. She did not have a bouquet toss at her wedding. Laughing at yourself makes you feel less crazy. Finding humor in heartache brings healing. Tell your stories to friends who can help you find the funny in them. You'll feel better, I promise. Waiting seasons don't have to be lost time, and they don't have to be the end of you. Expanding your spiritual survival skills will help you survive your trek through the barren places, however long, however winding. You might even make some happy memories along the way. But you can't make memories if you don't go make them. I pray that, like Hannah, you find courage to keep showing up to the places, people, and spiritual habits that can see you through day after day, month after month, even year after year. I pray that, like Hannah, blessing surprises you when you least expect it. Waiting Room Reading. For further study. Hannah's story is found in 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2, and you can read about the life of her son, Samuel, in 1 Samuel chapters 3 through 25. Journal prompt. Number 1. What do you need to start showing up to again? Worship? Prayer? Fun? Self-reflection? Number 2. What fun or exciting things would you like to try during this waiting season? Are there any trips you'd like to take, hobbies you'd like to pursue, new skills you'd like to develop? Prayer prompt. Guard me and deliver me. Do not let me be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and what is right watch over me, for I wait for you. God, redeem Israel from all its distresses. Psalm 25, verses 20 through 22, Holman Christian Standard Bible.
Chapter 4. Lies About Waiting. Naomi's Story, Waiting to Die. Based on Ruth Chapter 1. Naomi's eyes scan the hills, feeling the hum of familiarity. The comforting sense of home after days traveling desert terrain. With every step, she has tried to convince herself, wait till we reach Bethlehem. Home will heal you. But the rising swell of almost joy fizzles, sinks before cresting. When she left Bethlehem 40 years ago, she never could have imagined a homecoming like this. Widowed, childless, alone. Alone but for her beloved daughter-in-law, Ruth. Make conversation, Naomi, she chides herself, feeling Ruth's anxious eyes on her, studying her. Ruth needs it. See that rock there? She asks, pointing to a pockmarked boulder. Maybe I'm imagining things, but I think we took a break there that first day. The day Elimelech and I took the boys and left for Moab. She forces brightness into the words, knowing Ruth needs the memory that causes Naomi so much pain. We'd only ridden a short way, but Mahlon, he was only 5 then, was already whining, begging for water. As always, she senses Ruth's eager desperation, drinking in every detail about her dead husband, Naomi's youngest son, as if the stories could make him less dead. Elimelech and I rested while the boys wrestled in the grass. They were like lion cubs. A smile surprises her, and she stops talking, lost in memory. But Elimelech, how can you be so sure we'll be happy there with so much unknown? His strong arm draws her in close, his lips brush soft against her forehead. Because I know the only thing that matters, we'll be together. Together, together. Her feet mock the words. A boy jogs into view. Ruth hails him, presses a coin into his palm, exchanges words Naomi's dull ears cannot hear. When she turns back, Ruth's face is eager, coaxing. Naomi tries to summon a meager smile. The boy will tell everyone we're coming, Ruth says. He'll find your... our family. The boy sprints toward home, his agile feet leaving little puffs of dust behind.
Will they like me, do you think?
Ruth says so quietly, Naomi wonders if she meant to speak aloud. Naomi makes her voice firm. Daughter, my family will love you as much as I do. But anxiety squirms, snake-like in her gut. What if there's no one left? No one to remember me, to take us in? As the road crests, the town comes into view, spread out on the side of a rocky, grass-splotched hill, like a brown and green quilt.
Bethlehem, says Ruth, a hitch of excitement in her voice.
Naomi's heart flutters at the familiar sight, dusty houses clustered close, sharing secrets, scrubby trees tucked in tight, listening in. Minutes later, the first running figures appear, their colorful clothing bright polka dots against the tawny backdrop. The children reach them first, flushed and tongue-tied, giggling and waving shyly, until their mothers and grandmothers catch up in a swirl of skirts and excited chatter. Naomi scans faces with anxious eyes, seeking someone, anyone she once knew. The crowd parts. Two women, their faces bearing the tracks of time, hobble through, linked at the elbow. Their words weave on top of each other, braiding together in a tangle, so Naomi can't tell which one is speaking. Let us through. She's our cousin. Our friend. We will know. A grin sneaks onto Naomi's face. Rachel and Anna, I should have known you'd still be trying to out-talk each other after all these years. Together they cry, Naomi, it is you. And she is swept into a four-armed hug, nearly suffocated by the affection of old friends. At last they pull back to study each other. You've changed, cousin, Anna says, wagging a thick finger at Naomi's nose. So have you, Naomi says, pulling back from the finger, fighting tears and smiles, not sure which will win. You've grown shorter. So have you, sweet Naomi, Rachel says. So have we all. Just wait till the others see you. Sarah and Edith and Abigail, even Mary, all still living. So long we've wondered how you were, when you would return, if you would return. A young woman steps forward. From a red wrapping on her chest, a baby's curious black eyes peep out, dark jewels winking in bright sun. The woman gives Ruth a shy smile and places a hand on Rachel's shoulder. Mother, aren't you going to introduce us? Rachel draws herself up as tall as she can, proud smile shining. Naomi, this is Hadassah, my youngest, born 2 years after you left. And this little one, Joshua, is my 10th grandson. Naomi reaches a finger out to stroke the baby's soft cheek. Naomi raises her chin and steps back. And this is my daughter-in-law, Ruth. She feels Ruth's fingers lacing between hers, giving a squeeze, offering strength for the explanations they both dread. Naomi seeks the words, so hard to say. She sees Rachel's and Anna's eyes combing the road behind them. Again, their words intertwine, asking the same question different ways. Elimelech, Malan, Kilian, are they behind? Bringing your animals and children and... Naomi shakes her head, feeling the sorrow swell and crash inside, given fresh strength on this familiar soil. She had hoped she would salvage joy, find relief from grief at the sight of home and friends, but now she knows nothing has changed. "All gone," she whispers, "buried in Moab, that cursed land." And in the saying of it, the out loud speaking, the truth takes on fresh horror. The scab tears off the wound. She bleeds. Ruth's arm finds her shoulders.
"Naomi."
Rachel and Anna speak at once, their eyes mirrors of sadness. Behind them, all the faces offer sympathy, compassion, pity. The baby makes a feeble cry. Rachel and Anna step forward as if for a hug. Naomi's harsh voice is a slap against the space between them. "Don't call me that." The women freeze, arms outstretched and uncertain. "There is nothing, Naomi, nothing pleasant in my life anymore." She feels Ruth's arm twitch against her shoulders, knows she has hurt her, but it's too late. The flood of caustic words now released cannot be dammed. "Call me Mara," she says, "because my life is bitter, and the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Her eyes skip across the sad faces. "I left you full. I come back empty." Anna steps forward to place one hand on Naomi's forearm. "Come live with me. We will be your family once more, Naomi." "Mara," Naomi snaps, more angrily than she intends. Hurt flickers across Anna's face.
"Just wait, Mara,"
Rachel says, the name falling stiffly from her lips.
"You will find joy once more, here with us. You will see. Just you wait."
Naomi, Mara, feels a laugh jerk hard out of her chest. "There is no happiness left for me. Not so for Ruth. I intend to help her find new life here, but I wait only to die. Death will set me free."
Maybe your life isn't as bleak as Naomi's, but then maybe it is. When first we meet her, Naomi isn't waiting for blessing anymore. She waits only to be released from grief. Heart broken, dreams stolen. To lose a husband and two sons before their time is a sorrow beyond words. The future she once envisioned has died, buried with her beloved. And now hope, too, has died, strangled by Satan's lies. You can hear the enemy's evil manipulations hissing beneath her own words to friends. "The Lord's hand has turned against me. The Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Ruth chapter 1, verses 13 and 20 through 21. When we're waiting, life can feel empty. There's a void where it should be. We try to fill ourselves up, keep busy, but still the emptiness yawns, begging to be filled. And in that void, Satan starts to whisper. When we are waiting, we feel vulnerable, weak, exposed. Our confidence may be down, our faith wavering, and the enemy loves to exploit those weaknesses, slipping poisonous words through cracks in our armor. Jesus warned us about the words of Satan. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. John chapter 8, verse 44. Satan has a particular set of lies he has designed to torment us during waiting seasons. His deceptions target us where it hurts the most: insecurities in our relationship with God and insecurities about ourselves, our own spirituality, faithfulness, or worthiness. Because the enemy's words often ring with an element of truth, they are more difficult to fight. The trouble is, his lies often come with a scripture attached, a misunderstood scripture. They seem biblically sound, so we believe them. Just as Satan did with Jesus in the desert, he twists the truth so it almost sounds right. What are the lies Satan tells us during our waiting seasons? They are not unlike the lies he told Naomi, lies that convinced her to abandon her joy, her name, herself,